Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and this episode is Q&A number 104. Before we get into today's questions, big thanks to our sponsors. First, we have Precision Hydration that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Precision Hydration create electrolyte supplements that you can match to how you sweat, because there are large individual differences in how much sodium you lose in your sweat and also in how much you sweat, period, compared to somebody else. That means that in total, the replenishment needs for sodium in particular, but also other electrolytes, can vary drastically from one person to the next. And Precision Hydration help you solve that issue. They have a free online sweat test that will give you most a great ballpark estimate for how much sodium you lose in your sweat. And that can then be used to tailor your hydration strategy for you by buying a medium or high or low sodium concentrate electrolyte supplement. You can get 15% off your order with the promo code DETTRIATHLONSHOW15 on precisionhydration.com. And thank you to Roka that you can find on roka.com. Roka are the world-leading manufacturers of wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses. They're one of the most innovative companies in the endurance sports industry. They have come up with technologies such as the arms-up technologies, a technology available in all of their wetsuits and trisuits to help you have maximum shoulder mobility during your swimming. The exoskeleton that helps you maximize the use of your core in your swimming that they have in the new Maverick X2 wetsuit, and the Geico anti-slip technology that prevents any of their glasses from falling off of your face. You can get 20% off your Roka order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Now on to the first question from today, which is from Bento, who writes, "Hi Michael, I'm riding from Brazil. Love your work. I have used your training plans for sprint and half Ironman with great success. Podium in the half Ironman and several first places in the sprint races. My question is, you and several of your interviewees have said that volume in zone 2 is important, but running slow is difficult. What about walking fast? I have built a good volume this year, and my goal is to get to around 500 total training hours. And these total hours include quick walks in high zone 1 or low zone 2 heart rate. Every week I also do a tempo session, a long run, and hill repeats. I also do bike workouts and strength workouts. The walking has been great to get volume in and at the same time allow me to recover. Am I fooling myself though in counting these walks as hours counting to my training volume? I have felt great progress on my runs and my Garmin VO2 max has increased. Thanks and keep up the good work, Bento." All right, thank you Bento for your question, and also thank you for the great feedback on the training plans. The first thing I should say is that if you are progressing, which you're saying that you are, and you're noticing an increased run performance, then that's a great argument for keeping these fast walks in there. So I should say, though, that when assessing your progress, you should rely primarily on your performance, in whether it's in workouts or in training. So objective performance measures like how fast you run a specific set of intervals or a specific tempo run or something like that. The Garmin VO2 Max, I wouldn't put a great deal of stock into, so I would skip that. But if you are noticing progress in training or in racing, then that's the way it is. Then that's perfect. And if you are noticing this, let's assume that you are, then keep doing what's working for you. Because ultimately, we have to remember that we are all an experiment of N equals 1. And best practices and generally sound advice is great as a starting point. But we also should be individually optimizing our training to what really seems to be working for us. And that is the end point we want to get the most out of ourselves as athletes. That is also why I always stress the importance when using any training plans, including scientific triathlon training plans, that they should not be taken as gospel. They are great for a typical user. They are great starting points, but they work the absolute best when the user does adapt things to suit them the best. So based on things like previous experience and so on. And it sounds like this is exactly what you're doing. So that's great. So my individual advice to you is, as long as it's working, as long as you feel improvement, keep doing it, keep having those walks in there. And let you say that you get your heart rate to high zone one, low zone two, so that's perfect. And you can also, I think for listeners, generally speaking, getting your heart rate to 60 to 65% of your maximum, then it definitely has the kind of cardiovascular response that you would like to have from an easy run. And that seems to be the case for you. So absolutely, absolutely perfect. One thing I will say on walking is that I think that the best form of quote-unquote walking as a substitute for running would actually be to hike on hilly trails or hilly terrain, because then you can get all of the same cardiovascular benefits I just mentioned with the same heart rate response, but you would also stress the muscles more with a stronger strength component when going uphill without increasing the impact. And that's great. You get a specific muscular training, but you also don't increase the risk of overloading the bones, tendons, and ligaments too much. In addition, what goes up must come down. So when you are going downhill, hiking downhill, then this is fantastic eccentric training for your running muscles. And running is a sport that has high eccentric demands. In particular, eccentric hamstring strength is something most of us, including myself, could benefit from having more of, both for performance and injury prevention reasons. So if you can do your walks as hikes in hilly terrain, that would be fantastic. Now, if I answer your question from a more general perspective, without knowing in advance that, okay, it seems that you're clearly benefiting, but somebody that might want to try this, but we don't know if they will benefit or not, I would say in this situation that I think walking is really great for somebody who is brand new to running and with a beginner level fitness. For this athlete, fast walking that gets the heart rate up to the right level can form a reasonably big chunk of their run training for a good while, because you will get that cardiovascular stimulus we're after, but without overloading the bones, tendons, and ligaments. You will give them time to build up over time. And you'll lose some of the hardships of running, and you can slowly build up how much of your running is actual running and make sure that you don't injure yourself in the process. But what we must remember is that walking is not the same as slow running, even if you get the same heart rate response. Biomechanically, it's quite different, actually. So just like even a world-class cyclist cannot just expect to be a great runner despite having an amazing engine, we must do specific training for the actual movement patterns of running. And the only way to do that is to actually run. So as I said, we need to gradually build up if we're new to running, of course. And we can, wherever we are in terms of how much we're running, if we want to increase the running volume, it's always the same thing. You need to be careful when increasing your running volume and do it very gradually over time. For beginner runners, we still need to have that running in there, I think. You cannot just do walking and expect to get much better at running. If you are already doing most of your runs as actual running, which you are, Bento, then the question isn't really about replacing all runs per week with walking. The question is more about, is it okay to replace the lower intensity, the very easy runs that are zone one or zone two runs with walking? My general answer to that question would be to, as far as possible, keep running rather than walking. Maybe doing run walks actually could be a good compromise. So for example, 4 minutes of running, 1 minute of walking, because then you practice the specific movements of running and doing those movements efficiently at a low intensity. And becoming more and more efficient at that, gradually your heart rate will be getting lower for that same pace. If it's difficult to run slow enough for your heart rate to be reasonably low, then that is a situation when run walks can be really great, because then you can get your heart rate down during the walking segments. But another thing, or other things that you should do, would be to just try to minimize the factors that drive up your heart rate. So choose to run on flat courses for those runs where you want to keep heart rate down. Choose to run when the temperature is not too hot, so whether it's early in the morning or later in the evening. Do those sorts of things. In theory, you could argue that low intensity cycling would have the same benefit for running as fast walking would, because you can also get your heart rate to the exact same level with low intensity cycling. And since the movement patterns are so different between running and walking anyway, it doesn't really matter if you get in your aerobic cardiovascular training through walking or through cycling, except that it does matter if you are a triathlete, because then the cycling training will be specific for the bike. So doing more of this aerobic training on the bike would have crossover effects to running, just like walking would, but it would also be specific training for improving the bike. So same benefits on the run, more benefits on the bike compared to walking. So that's another thing to consider. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about how heart rate isn't everything when we determine whether we're running easy enough or not. So if you genuinely feel that you're running at a pace you could hold for several hours without slowing down, and if you can talk in complete sentences without huffing and puffing, then your low intensity probably is low intensity, even though heart rate is higher than you think it should be. And there are many potential reasons for this. For example, if you're not the most economical runner, then you may be using a lot of muscle mass, for example, muscle mass in your upper body, which then drives up oxygen demand and heart rate goes up a lot. And this is something that you might see in running, but not in cycling, because in cycling, you're stationary on the bike and only using your legs in a pretty economical manner. But if this happens to you, you're not the most economical runner and your heart rate goes up, it doesn't mean you're running too hard. It's only too hard if you are running so hard that your lactate is also higher than it should be. That's really the crux of it. So heart rate, of course, we use that as a proxy for lactate, just like we can use pace as a proxy for lactate or proxy for intensity, really. But the best way to measure it, what's happening physiologically, is by using actual lactate. And this is where it can get confusing, because if you are, as I said, less economical, then your heart rate might be a lot higher than somebody who's more economical. But in terms of lactate, you might be producing the same amount as the other runner. It's just that they're using less muscle mass because they are that much more economical than you are. So that's one thing to consider. And maybe if this applies to you, that your heart rate goes up very easily, even though it feels like you could hold that for several hours, that same pace, then consider getting a lactate test done, and they'll give you individualized heart rate zones for your lactate response, because standardized formulas may not work well for you for running, and that's something to be aware of, that the standard heart rate formulas, heart rate zones for running have a greater tendency to be not correct for the individual compared to cycling, again, because of that individual difference in economy, which is much, much smaller in cycling. The other thing you can do is to simply do the torque test when running at low intensity. So this has been validated by research studies that the torque test can be used to make sure that your low intensity remains low intensity even at an underlying physiological level. So in the study by Carl Foster, for example, the subjects were asked to read or to speak the Pledge of Allegiance out loud without huffing and puffing. But you can really just choose anything that has some normal sentence lengths to validate whether you're getting the intensity right. So if you combine doing this torque test during your easy runs with, which checks that cardiovascularly you're not running too hard, with assessing your RPE, so making sure that it feels like you could sustain that intensity for a long, 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 long time, then this would give you a really good indication of if the intensity is correct or not, even though heart rate may look to be too high at face value. Again, there are possible explanations for this, so it may not be. And just to reiterate, even though I said my general advice was to mostly prefer running to walking and maybe some run walks, because it is working well for you, specifically Bento, and you are improving, I would not recommend changing things. Just keep it as is as long as you're improving. One more important takeaway that I want to just reiterate here. I do think that hiking is excellent cross-training for triathlon and crossing over not just to running, but to cycling as well, with that muscular component, that strength component to it. So especially in the early base training part of the year, long hikes rather than long runs can be a really smart thing to add to a schedule, a training schedule, that is. So I hope this helps. Thank you, Bento, for your question. The next question is from Michaela in Stockholm, Sweden, who writes, "Hi, Michael. Thank you for an excellent podcast. You're doing a great job staying on top of research and presenting things in a nuanced way. It is by far the podcast I recommended to most people." Thank you for that, Michaela. "I am a 30-year-old female triathlete training for long distance. My question concerns periodization over the course of a training year and where to put my focus. I have done several lab tests for my VO2 max and my thresholds. My VO2 max is 72 and my anaerobic threshold is 260 watts or 4.3 watts per kilogram. The analysis that I got is that my thresholds in cycling as well as running are underdeveloped compared to the VO2 max. I'm still in relation to my aerobic capacity, to my VO2 max, I'm still quite slow, both at threshold pace and at race pace. This is especially prevalent in running. To give a benchmark, my 10-kilometer race time is about 40 minutes, which is very slow compared to what a female runner with my VO2 max would usually manage. It's not that I am an exceptional sprinter either that can hold on to speed, to high speed for longer durations. In fact, my top speed is quite low. I just don't seem to be able to use my entire engine, so to speak. How should I go about structuring my training year to get the most return on investment? On the one hand, my lack of speed might call for a polarized approach with lots of top-end work coupled with low intensity volume during the base phase. On the other hand, since VO2 is not the limiter in my case, I might be better off with a large block of threshold and sweet spot training, also far away from the race season. The challenge with this latter approach for me is that I usually build up quite a lot of fatigue after several weeks of zone 3 and zone 4 work. It might not be sustainable to put a lot of emphasis on this during the base phase, on this both during the base phase and in the race specific phase come spring. To sum up, I suspect I need to improve my economy and or the percentage or the fraction of fractional utilization, the percentage of VO2 max that I can hold over time. The question is, what strategy is most likely to be successful in this aspect? For context, I have 3 years of experience in triathlon, but some more in endurance sports, and train about 18 to 20 hours per week. I would really appreciate your input on this. Keep up the good work with the podcast." All right, thank you so much, Michaela. That is a great question, very interesting one. Quite long, but I read it all because I do think that all the context and details here are quite important in answering this question. So to give some context to the listeners, for a female triathlete, a VO2 max, or a female any athlete, a VO2 max of 72 is absolute world class. And 260 watts or 4.3 watts per kilogram for your threshold on the bike is also, it's outstanding, although you are absolutely right in saying that it seems to be low compared to your VO2 max. And the 40-minute 10K is definitely an example that shows this very, very clearly. That is very low compared to your VO2 max. But in a way, you can see it as a positive because it means that there's plenty of room for improvement. The VO2 max is basically the ceiling for your potential performance. It's your aerobic capacity. And your ceiling is very, very high indeed. So you mentioned there your lack of speed. And speed is always a tricky term because it's not always clear what one person means with speed can be doing 8-minute intervals or 5-minute intervals, which really isn't speed. What I think of as speed is like a 100-meter sprint and or maybe a 200-meter sprint, although the 200-meter sprint is also quite a lot about the really the glycolytic capacity. So really speed is something that is very short, measured in a few seconds, certainly less than 30 seconds. So I think that speed isn't something that you need to you really need to concern yourself with, because you don't need great speed to be a great long distance triathlete. That's definitely not a concern for you. And speed in particular on the run also has so much to do with biomechanics and strength. So it's not just that's not a reflection of really what your metabolic training should look like, although it might have implications for some other parts of your training, including your strength training. So all that to say is your lack of speed as you perceive it, and I don't know, again, if you're talking about 10 seconds or 4 minutes or whatever it may be, I'm assuming it's on the shorter end, like 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds maybe. That's not a sign that you're not using your engine, and that's not, so that's not, it, because it's really got nothing to do with your VO2 max. But what your high VO2 max shows us is simply that you have a massive aerobic engine. What we don't know, although we can take a guess, is how efficiently you are using that engine. And, well, that guess is obviously that you are not using it very efficiently, which could have a number of different explanations. So, for example, it could be that your economy isn't very good, as you suggest. So that would mean that you need more oxygen to go the same speed as athletes that are more economical than you. So you end up wasting a lot of the potential in your engine. And related to this, it would actually be interesting to know what your MAP, your maximum aerobic power, or your MAV, maximum aerobic velocity, which is usually measured as the last minute of an incremental test during which you assess your VO2 max. But it would be interesting to know that in relation to your to how economical you might be, at least in terms of the high power output and how high speed outputs. But another possible explanation for the fact that you're not good at the sub-maximal work or can sustain a high percentage of VO2 max, can't run that fast in a 10K and so on, is that you could have a high percentage of fast twitch fibers, even though you say that you are no sprinter. But the reason I'm thinking that this might be an explanation is that maybe you are using your fast twitch fiber oxidatively, which you can with the type 2A fast twitch fibers after appropriate training. But these fibers might not be very fatigue resistant for you. So you can produce massive VO2 values, use a lot of oxygen, take up a lot of oxygen into your muscles in a short graded exercise test, which is over in 10 minutes or 12 minutes or something, when you have your full pool of muscle fibers available to you. But in a 10K, maybe a large part of those two type 2A fibers end up fatiguing very quickly, way before the end of the race. So you're not able to go as fast, because then later on in the race, you're stuck with just your slow twitch fibers, and that relatively large pool of type 2A fibers that you might be using just aren't able to keep up with the demand. They're tired because they're not as fatigue resistant as the slow twitch fibers. It could even be that you are, in fact, not using your fast twitch fibers oxidatively, but rather that they are strongly glycolytic. So they produce energy from glycolysis anaerobically, and you end up accumulating lactate and correlated to that accumulating acidosis and fatigue. So strongly glycolytic athletes would normally be expected to maybe be good sprinters. So if you are by speed referring to sprinting, then this explanation goes a bit against what you're saying, that you don't have top end speed. But in running, at least, the possible counter argument for this would be that maybe you are very glycolytic despite not being a good sprinter, simply because sprinting is about much, much more than metabolism. Again, so much is biomechanics and so much is strength, actually. And even things like, you know, the elasticity of your tendons in your calf muscles and so on all play a part. But to answer the question on how to go about structuring a training year to get the most return on training investment, that is a very complex question that is really impossible to answer in an entire year of training periodization, really, with the information I have here. And it's something that really it takes a coaching relationship to optimize the training year. And even then, parts of the optimization are always going to be simply educated guesses. That's the nature of endurance sports and endurance coaching and coaching in any field, really. But as much as this may sound like or be a cop-out to answer your question, I think that with the engine that you have, with a VO2 max of 72, you really should get a great coach, because you have the potential to be an absolute world-class athlete. So my number one piece of advice, if you take nothing else away from this question, get a great coach. That is the number one way that you can get the most out of your training and optimize your training year. But let's be a bit specific, because there are some parts of your question that I can answer or make suggestions for. And that is that just looking at the perspective that you mentioned about choosing between focusing more on a polarized training approach with a lot of low intensity training and some very high intensity training versus a more pyramidal approach with a fair amount of work at kind of the mid zones, zone three, zone four, tempo or threshold type of workouts. This is where I think I can give some advice and some suggestions. And as you say, and as we've talked about, your VO2 max is already very, very high. This is not and will never be your limiter. Never, ever. It's high enough to win the most competitive races, really. It doesn't mean that you never should do high-intensity intervals, because they are useful for other things than raising your VO2 max too. But it probably means that you won't need to put a massive focus on high-intensity intervals. If we look at what your limiters are, it is definitely your ability to sustain a high fractional utilization or a high percentage of VO2 max. So in other words, we need to move your threshold, both your anaerobic and your aerobic threshold, closer to your VO2 max. And I speculated earlier about a few possible reasons for why they might be far away and why you can't have a high fractional utilization. The reality is that we don't really need to know the exact reason to know that this is the limiter, and we can also have a good idea of how to tackle this limiter. So what you should be training is the ability to sustain a relatively high percentage of VO2 max for longer and longer durations. And this type of training can be tempo training, sweet spot training, threshold training. They are all doing a lot of overlapping things for you at slightly different points on the intensity duration spectrum. So I would argue that as a long distance triathlete, you should also put a big, big emphasis on improving your aerobic threshold or your LT1, which is usually at around the top end of your zone 2. So below LT1 is kind of the low intensity zone. And for Ironman racing in particular, it would be even more important to raise your aerobic threshold as a percentage of VO2 max rather than the anaerobic threshold, because your aerobic threshold is closer to race pace. So I would suggest doing a lot of LT1 training. And so that can be, as a good estimate, 75% of max heart rate is a good place to start. And this may not be a challenging power when you do it, or pace when you do it. Let's use the bike as an example. For 2 hours, maybe it's, or 1.5 hours is maybe not challenging, but can you do it for 4 hours? Well, how does it feel in the fifth hour? So those are the kinds of workouts that really are quite low intensity, but can get quite tough towards the end when you build up the duration at them. Another argument for doing a lot of aerobic threshold training is what you say yourself, that you build up a lot of fatigue after a few weeks of lots of zone 3 and zone 4 training. So the solution is, don't do lots of zone 3 and zone 4 training. Do just enough that you don't build up fatigue, that you can keep doing it consistently week after week. But supplement with quite a reasonable amount of LT1 training, because that too can have overlapping effect. That too is just something that has overlapping effects at a different point on the duration intensity spectrum, with a lower intensity than the zone 3 and zone 4, but you can do that for a longer duration. So lesser cost, lesser metabolic cost, lesser mechanical cost. So you can do quite a lot of it probably. And especially considering your high volume, it's just one more argument for focusing more on LT1 work than you do on threshold and sweet spot work. Also, I would say that this is something that I apply with my athletes that are training at a high volume. We do emphasize kind of zone 3 tempo work above sweet spot and threshold work, just because the higher intensities, especially when you're training at a high volume, become very costly, and you just find it difficult to recover well enough. So a lot of LT1 work, a lot of zone 3 tempo work would be good kind of general guidelines for what to do. But then do only so much that you can keep doing it week after week. Also, I would include at least some work at high torques or low cadences on the bike, some hill running on the run. So for example, I like to give aerobic threshold runs tend to be, I give a 90-minute run or a 1 hour, 45 minute run to an athlete, and they might have 60 minutes or 75 minutes at their estimated aerobic threshold, which might be 75% of max heart rate. And I just tell them to go out and run on a hilly course. And that way you can include more of a higher strength and torque component there as well. But on the bike, it's very easy to control with low cadences, of course. So this can be have a benefit for lowering your glycolytic capacity or your VLA max in case it is high, which is one of the possible explanations for what you're experiencing. And it also has the benefit of making your type 2A muscle fibers more resistant to fatigue if that is an issue, which I also mentioned as another possible explanation for why your sort of athletic performance profile is the way it is. And what you want to do then is to basically do only so much zone 3 and zone 4 work that you don't accumulate too much fatigue, but you can keep doing it for week after week after week, because it takes time to establish really these adaptations. So the amount of zone 3 and zone 4 work that you're doing may seem way smaller than it should be, but if that's the case, but you can recover from it and do it week after week, it's okay. It's more important to consistently do that relatively small amount of work than to do too much and only do it for 3 or 4 weeks and then take 2 easy weeks, because you will, over the long term, you'll get much more benefits that way. So this is the main focus of your training, but by no means am I saying never go above threshold. I think you can and should do a little bit of high intensity work, basically maintenance, to make sure that you don't lose your high VO2 max, because you want to keep it. So an example of this is to just add some snacks of VO2 max maintenance. So for example, one way I might prescribe this to my athletes, let's say they have a tempo ride on the bike, I would add before the tempo segment, the main set of the ride, 4 times 1 minute at, let's say, 120% FTP, and then after the main set, another 4 times 1 minute, and it can be a 1 minute recovery, so 1-to-1 work to rest ratio. You just get in 8 minutes of work at VO2 max. It's not a lot, but it's enough for maintenance, because you need a lot less for maintenance than for building something in the first place. So that's what I would recommend. Remember, start small and build training load gradually. If you feel that you can handle the mid-zone work, the zone 3, the zone 4, the aerobic threshold work, then you can gradually add that as you're finding that you can handle it well and recover well. So I hope this helps, and good luck with your training. And that's it for today's Q&A. Keep sending in questions to michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And that's Michael with a K. As usual, you can find this Q&A and all previous Q&As on scientifictriathlon.com. And please subscribe to the podcast in your podcast app to not miss future episodes. Tune in on Monday when we're back with another fascinating interview. And this one will be with Dr. Bob Murray on all things glycogen, which is the stored form of carbohydrate in the body. So we do a real deep dive into how glycogen is used in training and racing, as well as how to effectively replenish glycogen and restore glycogen between workouts, which, especially for athletes that train at a high volume, may be one of the most challenging aspects of their training regimes, and perhaps one of the most underestimated ones as well. When you are at scientifictriathlon.com, you can also have a look at our coaching and our training plans, if that's something that interests you. There's plenty of information there that explains all about the process of these services and products, but you can also email me if you have further questions. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and take their free online sweat test to get a hydration strategy for your training and racing. And use the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW15 to get 15% off your order. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, and high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off with the promo code that you can find on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving triathlon.